Hello, and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with Max Linsky from Longform, and of course, Evan Ratliff from The Atavist.
Hey, Aaron. How you doing?
I'm good. Good. Here in our studio, Dumbo, New York.
Feels good to be back. Frosty day.
This week on the show, I talked to Wesley Yang. Do you guys know Wesley Yang?
I've seen Wesley Yang's work.
Yes. He wrote a very piece that caused a big splash a few years ago for New York Magazine called Paper Tigers, which I guess you would say is about the Asian American experience, for lack of better terminology. But he's written a bunch of other interesting stuff for N Plus One. He's an unusual guest for this show. I feel like we get a lot of precocious, super ambitious people who have had like sort of a dazzling rise in their career. And he is not that kind of a person. He's a person who struggled to figure it out through a lot of his life and poured a lot of himself into his writing before like really like building an audience or taking any sort of a careerist path. So I thought he was a really interesting person to talk to.
Sounds like an interesting one. An intense one, perhaps.
Yeah, it's an intense episode. If you don't like intensity, skip this episode.
Who among us does not like intensity?
I do like intensity. If you want to send people some intense emails, how would you do so?
If it were me,
yeah,
like, I'd use MailChimp.
Evan took a real pause there and thought about that one.
I was thinking, what are the options for sending email to a lot of people? And I settled on MailChimp.
They are our sponsor. MailChimp powers over 8 million businesses. And not just businesses. They power bands and bakeries. Bakeries is my go-to example. So anyway, MailChimp, they're always sponsoring us, and we always appreciate it. Thank you, MailChimp.
Here's Aaron with Wesley Yang.
Okay, welcome, Wes Yang.
Thanks
for coming in. I think I became aware of you as a writer from this 2011 piece that you wrote that I'm guessing has been kind of like a, if you Google Wesley Yang, it's like this article and like 7,000 responses to this article. So
right.
I figure it's as good a place to start as any to talk about your life and writing. Uh-huh. The article is called Paper Tigers. I'm sure you're sick of talking about it, but for people who haven't read it, what were you trying to take on in the piece?
Well, so if you'll recall, back in February of 2011, the Wall Street Journal ran an op-ed by a Yale law professor named Amy Chua, and it was an excerpt from a book that she had, a memoir that was coming out called sort of Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. And it had a title that was intended to be provocative. It said, why Chinese mothers are superior.
Yeah.
It was a little bit unstable. The tone was, you know, somewhat sort of satirical or self-parodic, but it was also sort of earnest, and especially the way that it was framed with the headline. And she described being sort of the way Chinese parents raise their children.
Yeah.
Her daughter was not allowed to, she had to play violin. She was not allowed to sort of do a sleepover.
Yeah.
And sort of it made the statement, among others, that Chinese, some of the methods that we use could in fact be legally actionable. And this was said in a tongue-in-cheek way, but it's also kind of true, right?
Right.
You know, depending on what jurisdiction you happen to fall in. And
yeah. Certainly, like, socially unacceptable in, like, certain American circles.
Right. And so she was making the link between that and between the success of Asian American students.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my editors at New York came to me and they were like, oh, you know, you're an Asian person. Do you have anything to say about this?
Is that an experience you have had as a writer a lot? Is like, hey, you're Asian? Like,
well, prior to that, really, no, because it's not typically throughout sort of most of my adult life been an interest of, you know, been a subject of real journalistic intrigue. Right.
Right.
But there is this aspect in which, you know, there is concern among upper middle class American parents who are obsessed with getting their children into the Ivy League that they may have become too lenient with their kids, and you know, it may not be an entirely unjustified concern, right?
Yeah.
And so that story went huge. It became viral, and I think that was a kind of early stage at which things started to get viral, where you could sort of you could troll whole racial groups, and it would become an enormous like everybody would share it and everybody would comment on it.
It was probably like in the top 10 first big outrages on the internet.
Right. And so because it was the first, it had such an intense impact. And
yes.
So, you know, my initial my initial sort of reaction to this request was I was intrigued by it in some ways, but I was also somewhat resistant to it because one had an intuitive sense that you would be feeding this beast that was coming into emergence. And we didn't quite know the sort of dimensions and the contour of what it would mean to feed that beast. I was like, well, what do you want me to say about it? Right, was sort of my attitude. And they're like, well, why don't you just start talking to people? And sort of bit by bit, you know, the first thing I discovered was that, you know, that Stuyvesant High School, which is the sort of the math science elite school in New York that you have to test into, was 70% Asian, which is, you know, a dramatic increase from what it had been a decade ago. And it indicated to me that this was something that I could start trying to look into. And I just started looking for contacts. You know, I have my own sort of complicated relationship to being an Asian person. And so, you know, the piece ended up being a very strange kind of stew of different elements where it opens up with memoir and then it goes on to sort of review some data and then to present scenes from different parts of the world that was more or less designed to provide a counterpart to the sort of tiger mother narrative.
In many ways, it's... like if the tiger mother narrative is documenting a form of Asian parenting, whether it's real or imagined or whatever, your piece imagines the life of children, mostly men, who grew up in the households that are described in the tiger mother book, right?
I mean,
was that something you knew going in, like I'm going to do sort of tiger children or?
I think so.
Yeah.
Asians in America are still 70% foreign born. Which is a fact that I think that surprises a lot of people.
It shocked me. If you had asked me to gamble, I would have said 5%.
New immigrants just kept coming and coming and coming. And so what I noticed at the time was sort of I grew up in a sort of mostly all-white suburb of northern New Jersey, surrounded by second-generation Asian kids who were pretty clear about like wanting to assimilate, right? And so, you know, they played soccer, they played football, and it seemed like the trajectory that we were moving toward was the eventual sort of disappearance of this as a distinctive ethnicity, right? But 40 years hence, what I saw was that these initial sort of immigrant patterns had been renewed because of more immigrants who had that sort of, fresh off the boat energy. Now, you know, like, third-generation Asian-American immigrants, you know, those kids are like in eighth grade now. And, you know, they're going to be different and we'll, you know, we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, we're all, most of us are either immigrants who arrived here or the children of immigrants.
Yes.
And immigration is, for the people who do it and for the children who endure it, it's a trauma, right?
Yeah.
And it's a trauma for a lot of different reasons. And one of the reasons it's a trauma is that there is this cultural divide that you have to bridge. And so, you know, for me, the issue that I kind of wanted to look at was the sort of the invisibility and the absence of the Asian person. And it just, you know, at some level, it just has to do with how few of us there are. Like 6% of the country is nominally Asian American, but Asian American is also an umbrella term invented by ethnic entrepreneurs who wanted to sort of have our own distinctive category of identity politics. And so it encompasses South Asians, it encompasses the Chinese, people who are very quite culturally distinct from one another and who don't share a language, don't share a national history. And then, of course, until 1965, you know, sort of Asia, you know, there was Chinese exclusion through the 1920s. And so there isn't much of a history. You know, we in your history books, you may learn about sort of Chinese immigrants who came as prospectors for gold or who built the railroads. But for the most part, it was like an almost entirely male cohort of workers. And they went back or they just kind of dissolved into the general population. Or they had these Chinatowns where there's, you know, there's some continuity. But really, like, the vast, vast majority of Asian Americans came after 1965.
Yeah.
Where you had lots of graduate students and people in technical fields. And so there was it was a demographically distinct group of people that came. And of course, there's class divides within that as well, right? There's a large population in Flushing of illegal immigrants, you know, and a pipeline of people that will work in Chinese restaurants around the country and who live under, you know, conditions of poverty and need.
Patrick Radden Keefe, he did that piece about the human smuggler in Chinatown, which I think another sort of shocking fact to me was that, like, if you look at people who work in restaurants in, say, New York City Chinese restaurants, 98% of them are from a single province of China. They are basically a single ethnic cohort. They have almost nothing to do, like almost nothing to do with even Chinese immigration. They're basically a single pipeline.
There's like a village, right, that has been doing that, has been leading this postmodern existence since the 19th century.
Yeah.
What's fascinating about those kids is that their parents are very poor, and their parents don't have the ability to raise them, really, because they're working all the time. But they're here for a purpose, and that purpose is to use the educational system as a route to upward mobility.
To make a better life.
Right. And so in spite of having parents who don't speak the English language and who don't have a high school education and who live under conditions of very dire poverty, they scrape together whatever they can to send these kids to these private academies that prep them in test taking.
Yeah.
And they get into Stuyvesant at a rate of 70%. To the point where, you know, there's now pushback on that. And sort of my article came out at a time before the pushback. I think my article indicated that something like 600 people were offered admission to Stuyvesant. They scored high enough.
Right.
It was like 380 Asians and 100 whites.
Yeah.
And 7 blacks.
Yeah.
And maybe like somewhat fewer than 20 Hispanics, right, in a public school system that is majority black and Hispanic. So this is the area where Asians become visible, right? Because they're putting pressure on something that is interesting to the sort of upper white middle class reading public. And, you know, there's right now there's a push to change the sort of protocol of admission into Stuyvesant to make it more holistic and and, you know, there are many different schemes where you can get greater representation. And sort of the nominal thing that is at stake here is black and Hispanic representation, right? But that in a way, I see that as kind of a, like, more white middle-class families want a shot also, right? And so they can...
It's a way to backdoor in some white people.
If yeah, no, exactly.
Like, spread it around here a little bit.
I think they want to knock that 80, because now it's gone up to 80%. They want to knock down the 80% to 45, 50, you know, and they can raise the black and Hispanic numbers through a holistic admissions process that is... You know, necessarily gives them discretion to do whatever they like.
Yes.
Right? And you know, and then bump up the whites also, right? Because that's in the end, that's how you build support among politically active constituencies, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what's happening. And I think, you know, from one perspective, it makes perfect sense and it's okay. And and from another perspective, you know, there's these complicated politics around it. But these kids are demonstrating that you can have every possible disadvantage, and you can still, through one's dogged hard work and persistence and really no other assets, right, like, make it into an elite education in America, right? Like, it's, they're doing it
at some cost to themselves,
and that's part of what, like, I wanted to document. But, you know, the more I looked at it, the more I began to see that the cost sort of, it's like they're losing out on things, on a well-roundedness or a, that they probably weren't going to have or get anyway, except, you know, there are always individual cases where it, you know, it's possible. But so, like, you know, the first person that I interview sort of gets really disillusioned at Stuyvesant with the grinding that he has to do and the relentless competition of the place.
And the seeming appearance that white students are somehow immune to that same grinding competition and are sort of leading these bohemian, freewheeling lives while in the same school as them.
Right. And he asks himself, well, why is this not possible for me? And that's this moment of great like tension, opportunity, and also danger, right?
Yes.
For a person. And because if there's a path that you know will lead to a $70,000 a year income as a management consultant or an accountant or whatever it is, the safe path that these kids are being encouraged to do in order to vindicate all of the sacrifices and hard work that your parents did to put you in a position to do this, you know, the risk of attempting something different, you know, in most cases is just going to be too high for you to stray from that path, right? And so the people who will stray from that path are those who can really just do no other. Right.
What was your own experience of trying to break into writing as a 22-year-old?
Like? Well, you know, when I think of my experience generally, I was a pathologically sort of clueless, oblivious person in every aspect of my life. Sort of, and I was just living in this kind of internal exile from which, at this, you know, to be honest, you know, I don't know for a fact that I've passed out of it.
Did you realize that you were clueless when you were 22?
No, I recognized it all along. I didn't know what I was doing. I was a bad student at Rutgers, and I didn't do well. And I you know I had I'd never lived up to my potential in any way. So, you know, in a lot of ways, the tiger child sort of narrative is not. It relates to me in some ways in a very direct way, right?
Right.
But obliquely, because it's not one that I followed, right?
Right.
So I graduated in the bottom half of my class, and you know, and yes. I failed calculus in my senior year, and you know, I had really bad quantitative skills, but the only thing that I could do was that I could to some degree write.
Right.
Like my view of whether a person can write or not is, I think if you metabolize a certain threshold, this is my Gladwellian theory, right? If you metabolize, like you read a certain number of books before puberty, right? You'll have a basic sense of how language is supposed to feel. And there's actually, I don't think that there's a way to, if you read 10 times the number of books after puberty, I don't think you're going to get the same foundation for like the basic intuitive sense of the way language is supposed to feel on a page in order to be good.
Yes.
And so I got that, and I also encountered in the fifth grade this sort of this like unusual, very old school, you know, hard ass lesbian teacher that sort of made us diagram sentences, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, if those two things hadn't happened, you know, I would have no skills at all, like no ability to function in the world. I lacked all of those things, right? The ability to function in an office. I lacked the ability to sort of be socially acceptable with an employer. But I could write to some degree.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to put these guys on hold for just a second, tell you a little bit about the sponsors who are helping us pay bills this week. Thank you, sponsors. First up is Trunk Club, and if you are in New York, like I am in New York, you're starting to feel a little hint of spring there. It's starting to get a little warmer. You're leaving that winter coat at home. It's starting to feel good. Those winter doldrums are fading, but your clothes, they have also faded from style. It's time for some new ones, and Trunk Club is the way to go. They take the hassle out of shopping by finding the best clothes for you and your style. You're going to look and feel amazing, and you'll always have the perfect clothes for spring. If you go to trunkclub.com/longform, all you have to do is answer a couple simple questions about your style, your preferences, your size, and then you're going to get a personal expert stylist, someone to choose clothes just for you. They're going to handpick clothes from the best premium brands, and then they're going to send you a trunk with all the stuff they think you'll like. All you have to do is approve of what you do like and send back what you don't. It's totally free shipping both ways. If you go to trunkclub.com/longform, someone's going to style you for free, and you're only going to pay for the clothes that you keep. Go ahead, go to trunkclub.com/longform. That's trunkclub.com/longform, and get a trunk filled with the clothes you'll love wearing. Thanks, Trunk Club. So if you want to look good, you need some new clothes. If you want to feel good, you need some new food, and maybe that food should come delivered straight to your door, like our friends at Home Chef do. With Home Chef, you get all the fresh ingredients you need, plus instructions to cook restaurant-quality meals in under 30 minutes. And it all just comes straight to your door once a week. They're chef-designed, restaurant-quality recipes. You can get a rustic vegetarian tart with spinach, roasted red peppers, and goat cheese. How about a little maple miso glazed salmon with Brussels sprouts and apple? Or even a Parisian bistro steak with creamy potatoes and green beans. These are fantastic meals that you can make in your own house. And you can make them in under 30 minutes. This is something you can actually pull off during the week, which is something we all need, or at least I need. I've been eating gross crap all winter. I'm fat. I feel poorly. And it's time to change that. I'm going to do it with Home Chef. So here's what you should do if you want to be like me and change that diet of yours. Go to homechef.com/longform. Use the code longform at checkout. You're going to get $20 off. Each meal is under $10. So that's two free meals, basically. Homechef.com/longform. Rediscover home cooking. Okay, let's get back to Wesley and Aaron.
So in some ways, your experience, I mean, what you were doing as a child that lined you up to be who you are now is not actually entirely different than some of these sort of tiger upbringings. You were just interested in reading, not playing a violin.
I was interested in what I was interested in,
right?
Which is not really what I should have been interested in.
And that was self-directed on your point. No one was saying like, oh, go read a bunch of these great novels or anything like that.
In the eighth grade, I started to, you know, like my brother had, he brought home from college like a Nietzsche reader, right? And so this is very exciting to me. And I read that, right?
Yeah.
And
what was reading Nietzsche as an eighth grader like? I feel like it's almost dangerous to expose an eighth grader to Nietzsche.
Well, I think it is dangerous. And I think whatever bad thing is supposed to happen definitely happened, right?
Yeah.
So very early on, even as just like a ninth grader, I had already developed some notion of myself as an intellectual, right? But it was totally unmoored, right? And like disconnected to anything real. There was also like, at the school that I went to, there's this Asian American sociologist who talks about stereotype promise, right? Which is that like Asians benefit from stereotype promise. There's this idea of stereotype threat, which is that like when like women or blacks or other people who are expected to perform less well, like women on math tests.
It's the opposite.
So the opposite is that like people will think that you're smart and therefore you will be perceived as smart and you will be treated in ways that create a certain expectation to which you will probably rise.
And yes.
And I definitely benefited from stereotype promise, right?
Yeah.
And I was regarded as intelligent. But in addition to this, I had a somewhat precocious and nascent notion of myself as what we would think of as an intellectual, right? Even though I didn't really know what that meant. But I sort of wanted to separate myself from my peers and my tastes and my interests. And I think like people who develop that sense of themselves early tend to be the ones that then go on to do this thing.
Which has become an adult misanthrope in a way.
Yeah.
And I describe you as a misanthrope based on your self-description in these writings.
Sure.
At least in your early 20s, you describe yourself as someone who basically was obsessed with being different than other people and sort of being off a track.
Right. And actually just was, right? Like,
yeah.
Actually just like lacked the ability to conform.
Yeah.
You know, there are all sorts of ways to lack the ability to conform, right? And there are people, you know, they have enormous sort of personal charisma, or they find ways to make a business out of whatever is idiosyncratic or distinctive about themselves. And, you know, I didn't have any of those things, right? So I was just kind of a lost 20-year-old. You know, I worked at a regular newspaper.
What paper?
A Gannett paper in New Jersey. You know, like I drifted out of college. I didn't have a degree. It had been 4 years. So I needed a job. I went to work for like one of those free weekly papers they throw onto, you know, and I didn't know anything about journalism. I guess I'm just sitting here.
No, I mean,
confessing to have always been a lost person and still be. So
but I think you've channeled it into something in that, when you describe that sort of inability to conform and to sort of understand what's wanted, you the subjects of your writing often, you profile people who, this is a quality of them as well. So you've written profiles of Eddie Huang,
yeah,
who runs a restaurant in New York and has TV shows and is like celebrity chef is almost, I think, a sort of insulting term, but he's a celebrity chef.
Right.
And then you've also written about the Virginia shooter.
Sung Wee Cho.
Both Asian men within 10 years of your age, I would guess.
Yeah.
Who were unable to fit in with the program and took totally divergent paths around it.
Yes.
Do you see yourself as like a foil for those people?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking back the other day about like what things I have been interested in. What was I interested in my 20s? I was interested in Welbeck. I was interested in the elementary particles. I was interested in Fight Club.
Yeah.
I was interested in pickup artistry. This is before all of these things had sort of metastasized into what they've turned into. And yet, you can see the germ of a certain set of interests. I'm interested in some ways, you know, I'm interested in masculinity. I'm not this kind of testosterone-driven man, but I am interested in the fact that, like, men commit murders at a rate 8 times that of women. And so I'm interested in, you know, the fact that most of the violence and the problems in the world come from some power-seeking elements that exists in men, and that when it's frustrated will often, you know, the response can be very creative, right? Or it can be very destructive. And there's this term that I found in, I got it via Fukuyama, who takes it from Plato, this thumos. I don't even know how to say it, but the spiritedness of the guardians, right? It's the part of a person that Plato theorized. We have logos, we have our reason, and we have pathos, which is feeling, but we also have this third element, which is the thing in a person that rises up, you know, in response to what it perceives as an injustice and takes the form of a demand for recognition. And that demand for recognition is something that I think every misanthrope knows, right? Because one goes through life unable to partake of habitual paths to recognition, right? And either through some means finds a way to gratify that desire, or in the absence of that means spirals into misanthropy, you know, violence, hate, and so on. And so that trajectory is one that, you know, sort of in my own sort of fantasy / emotional life, I've lived.
Yeah.
So it's easy for me to write about it, you know,
yeah,
and the different forms that it takes with different people.
A common moment that you cite in the life of the misanthrope is the moment where they make a crucial decision, sort of which path to go. You describe the Virginia shooter show, the moment he hired an escort to dance for him in this hotel room, and he tries to touch her and she sort of recoils. Like what could have been different there? Or in the case of your profile of Aaron Swartz, a very, very different kind of misanthrope, knowing that basically like a week later, had he not committed suicide, there was going to be this change in his legal case that could have radically shifted his perspective on it. Like in many ways, when I take this sort of police lineup of misanthropes that you've profiled, they're all kind of like one, like divergent paths of a single person. It's in a way a feeling you get when you put them all together. When you bring that up in your own life, was there a moment like that for you that your life forked?
Well, I don't know that there is a specific moment, but you know, I had been a journalist, and then I didn't have any notion of, you know, what it meant to be in New York, and I didn't have any access to it. I was living in New Jersey, working at a suburban newspaper, and I think that was sort of the peak of my misanthropy, right?
Yeah.
It's just sort of driving around in this like featureless, exurban landscape, and you know, couldn't even like muster any energy to have a dream about something else.
Right.
But you know, I did want to write, and I had a friend who started to write for Feed magazine, and then through that, I just like met one person, right? And I persuaded one person to let me review a book for Salon, And then that's kind of all I was doing. I was just like trying to get people one by one to let me write something here or there. But really what happened was sort of, you know, very early on, I met this guy called Keith Gessen. You know, I met, you know, I remember, you know, very vividly, this was like 2002 or yeah. this is pretty early on. And he was like, oh, we're going to start this magazine and, you know, it's going to be called N Plus One. And, you know, I was kind of a vague hanger-on of the N Plus One scene for a few years.
Yeah.
And then the Cho thing happened and yeah. they were like, oh, this, you know, we know an Asian guy, you know, maybe, you know, maybe we get him to write something about yeah. it. And I just started to write this thing and yep. It just involved surfing around the internet, like finding crazy stuff. And it was a good story in so many ways because he was a creative writing student and he left behind a manifesto, which was then aired on television.
Yeah.
And so it was the, you know, it was the inauguration of something that we've now become very familiar with and that we have a clear taxonomy
the
sort of
the postmodern shooting.
Which is like the sort of the angry individual male
right.
who is a virgin or
right.
highly sexually frustrated, who experiences catharsis through, you know, by means of an AK-47.
Right.
And so there was just all of these like gory, grody, you know, kind of sub-pornographic details that emerged, and you could just like put them into a piece, right?
I didn't know a lot of that stuff. This is always the trip to me. Like, I actually thought I was fairly knowledgeable about that shooting. I remember, I think Jay Caspian Kang also wrote a piece in mm-hmm. which he also lightly identified with the. I was like, this is a weird echo. I don't think I've read this N plus one thing, but someone else I know has also like written something where they were like, yeah, I can see myself in that person. But the details I didn't know were like that he was a student of Nikki Giovanni's and had actually disrupted her class. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of these coincidences are just like, if this was fiction, I would be like, come on.
Yeah,
like, seriously? Yeah. Tell people who are listening sort of the role of that Nikki Giovanni section in this N plus one piece on Cho.
You know, Nikki Giovanni is a creative writing professor at Virginia Tech, and Cho was enrolled in the class, and he would intimidate and frighten people just by his demeanor.
Yeah, and his writings.
In the class, and also by in his writings that, you know, involved some fantasies of violence and so forth. Although a short story that he wrote, it doesn't end with an actual killing, right? But he finds a female collaborator to
right.
participate.
And they go on, they sort of are about to go on a murdering spree.
They've armed themselves and it ends, but we don't actually see the spree. We don't know
yeah.
what happens. But, you know, he would show up in sunglasses and he would just act in a way that everybody thought he was crazy, and they were right to think so.
Yeah.
But she herself had, you know, she had herself had been in the 60s a black nationalist poet, and she had written this poem, you know, I can't say you know, but it used the N-word a lot, and you know,
yeah.
It is she's speaking to an unnamed N-word interlocutor, and
yes.
Asking him whether or not he's just going to kill his own or whether he's going to start killing white people.
Yeah.
It goes on and on in this incantatory way, saying, you know, can you kill a whitey? Can
yep.
can you rape a blonde head? Can you, you know, piss on a blonde head?
It's pretty much confrontational in a way that echoes some of the ways that Cho's writing could have been perceived.
Well, that's what she had written, and
yeah.
and that was okay.
Right.
Because it fit within a certain established rubric of ethnic grievance that you know, certainly by now, by that time, we had all learned to sort of digest, absorb,
right.
and contextualize historically. Whereas what Cho was doing was not okay, right? And it was not okay because it was a violent psychopath.
Yes.
But also because even if it wasn't somebody who was mentally ill, it was untethered from anything that anybody wanted to recognize as a form of grievance. And
yes.
it's been followed up by other things that have, I think, helped us fill in the gaps and recognize that there's a taxonomy there, right?
Yes.
Of just men whose demand for recognition and whose intrinsic power-seeking element has not been satisfied and who will resort to violence in order to satisfy it.
You very like clearly in the piece liken your experiences to those of the Cho and empathize with them, I would say. And
I guess I'm curious as to whether that worried you, to do that, people's reaction to someone who is clearly empathizing with the biggest mass killer in American history.
Right.
And I was in some ways shocked while I was reading it, just how dark you were willing to be about yourself. Like it's not that I don't have those impulses, but I've never said like, yeah, I empathize with a mass shooter. Like I feel some of that inside myself.
Well, you know, it's like there's a series of concentric circles, right? And and one of the circles is like people who have felt alienation, right? And there's like millions of people who fit into that circle.
Yeah.
Right? And then like you continue to narrow that circle, right?
Yeah.
And we've filled in a lot of gaps in sort of like recent American political history about, and then like people who understand what would lead people to emphasize with Donald Trump, right?
Yes.
And then like people who blah, 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 blah. And then you get tighter and tighter. And then eventually you arrive at, like people who have lost their minds, people who are capable of, of psychotic rage.
Yeah.
Right. And so, I would put myself in a circle where I have experienced like a profound alienation from the world. And that's the level at which, I can register and feel empathy for Cho. And I think actually that circle is actually pretty big, right?
Probably the size of that circle is commensurate with how much attention people like Cho and Rogers do get. I mean, I don't think that story would be as interesting to America if there weren't a lot of people who kind of felt something emotionally about themselves, not just from the perspective of the victims, but also from the perspective of the killer.
There was a kind of like artlessness to the Cho piece in the sense that like, I would say 80% of it was written in a single draft, right?
Jesus. This is a Kindle single.
It's like
people.
A 10,000 word piece.
Yeah.
But like most of it was just written very spontaneously, and we just worked on it and worked on it, and multiple editors went through all of these attempts to make it different or better, but there was just a kind of there was a kind of holistic thingness to it,
yeah,
where even its sort of flaws and convolutions all had to just remain as they were.
Yeah.
And so at the end we're like, oh, we're just going to print this like the way you initially emailed it to us.
Oh, really?
And yeah, it was just kind of an email in a way, even.
That's like a very artful email. I mean, I'm very impressed if you're able to write at that level in an email.
In the sense like I'm only able to write at that level in an email is a thing, right?
Interesting.
And I'm not always able to do it. But yes, your question as like, is it risky? It's both risky like psychologically, internally, to like go to those places.
Yeah.
And then there's also like once you have done it and you've produced something that you feel resonates and has power to it, but you're also like really afraid, right? About like what people are going to think about it. Like what your peers are going to think about it in relation to you and just like what a broader general public will conclude about you. And some people were like, well, don't publish this.
And that's part of Paper Tigers also. I mean, Paper Tigers is in many ways a catalog of the emasculated Asian male, which Wes Yang is putting himself, in that concentric circle very firmly.
Yes.
Well,
the M+1 piece, you asked earlier about a turning point, and that was definitely a turning point.
Oh, interesting.
Right? I had received very little recognition as a writer, and I wasn't really deserving of any recognition as a writer prior to that piece. But then it came out, and for about a month afterwards, I got emails, several emails every day.
Oh, really?
From people who were saying things that like writers don't say to other writers, which is like, they didn't say I wept, right?
Yeah.
But they were like, I'm ashamed of myself as a writer. Like somebody said that, right?
Yeah.
And nothing can make a writer feel better than having another writer tell them they feel ashamed of themselves as a writer, right?
Did that serve as a validation for you?
It served as a point that like this, I can be a writer, which is not, even though I was in my early 30s, it was totally unclear whether, I actually had anything to add, and it turns out that I did. Of course, I feel like profound ambivalence about this being the thing that I have to add, right? Like the accounts of emasculated, embittered Asian men, right? But it showed that, like, if a person remains true to some part of their experience, no matter what it is, and they present it in full candor, that there's value to that, and people will recognize it. And so, like, once I knew that that was true, I knew that I could do this.
There's a moment in that Cho piece. I'm sorry I keep bringing this Cho piece. It's now that's 10 years old. You must be like, wow, that guy's really into my old shit. Uh-huh. But where you basically like trick the reader into thinking something racist.
Uh-huh.
You're like, imagine the person like serving you Mexican food. Like, okay, here are a bunch of logical thoughts that you have there. I'm like, okay, yeah. And then you're like, you're racist. And I'm like, oh, you got me. I mean, there is a certain gotcha where I feel like you use this tactic of like leading people on a series of like logical leaps that end somewhere horrific at the end. When you make someone uncomfortable like that, like, what's your intention? What are you trying to do to the reader in that situation?
The contemporary novelist that I was interested in, you know, was Welbeck, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, not just because of the themes.
Yeah.
You know, and where it has culminated, right, in his kind of, you know, his sort of embrace of Islam, right? And
yeah.
He has said that he's an Islamophobe, he's an Islamophobe. He doesn't know anything about it, but he's... Yeah. He's also very attracted to it, right? Like, there's something very sincere about his embrace of it.
Yes.
Right? Because he's... The basic sort of trajectory, right, of the novel is, like, the discovery of individual moral autonomy.
Yeah.
Right? And then it sort of... It ends in Welbeck, right? When, like, individual moral autonomy, when it becomes universalized, like, produces these, like, totally atomized and lost individuals who want to relinquish their moral autonomy to anything... up to and including Allah, right?
Right.
And that part of the drama that he's writing, you know, and it may be not that different than what Dostoevsky was writing about, right, is the part that has great compelling power, rhetorical and otherwise, and conceptual power. And it's what's interesting to me. And so I always say to myself, you know, I should switch to fiction, right? Because that's where this stuff gets dramatized, but I just didn't. I didn't have the courage to do that.
Did you dabble in fiction?
No, I've never had the courage to do anything. I've never had the self-certitude to do any of that. Right. I need some kind of factual predicate to get me to do stuff. Right. And so, you know, I basically am just scanning the world for things that fit that factual predicate, and then try to shoehorn it into some nonfiction, but. You know, like, what am I trying to do? I'm just trying to affect people. Some people just have this basically gadflyish temperament, you know, which is not to say that I don't have, like, good political instincts that you know, people in Brooklyn would admire.
Right.
And,
you're not, like,
you know,
a, you're not a Donald Trump supporter.
No,
really.
Right. But to be a journalist that focuses on that is, it's like, there are journalists who want to affect some change in the world, And then there are those who just, like, want to arouse himself and others. And I'm still trying to learn what it would mean, right, to have that mission-driven sense, right? But in the interim, I just, in a sense, want to develop my powers to be able to affect people rhetorically.
Ta-Nehisi Coates was on the show, and he said something that connected to what you just said.
I think that's definitely what he's doing, by the way.
It was interesting. He said, you know, you come out with this book, and now my email box, I can't remember if he said this on the show or in the bar downstairs, so Ta-Nehisi, sorry if I'm blowing off your spot, but, you know, my email box is full of activists, people who want me to appear at a Black Lives Matter rally or to contribute writing to an anthology about social activism. And he's like, I'm not by nature an activist. I'm by nature a writer. I'm willing to talk. Like, we could have a dialogue. You know, I'm not saying no.
Right.
But I'm a thinker, and as a thinker, I'm trying to provoke people and change how they think about things. And as an activist, you may not like the conclusion I come to. My conclusion may be things aren't going to change.
Right.
They'll never change. And that's an acceptable conclusion to come to as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an acceptable conclusion to come to as a social activist.
Right.
And therefore, a social activist and a writer are different camps fundamentally.
Yes. And so, like, to me, in some ways, I resent Asian identity politics being foisted on me as a theme. On the other hand, it's the very sort of invisibility, marginality, the fact that, like, people really profoundly don't care about it.
Yeah.
There's a way you could make a virtue out of all of those things. And through Cho and through the Paper Tigers people, oh, I saw that there was a way to make a virtue out of those very qualities of it. And in a way, it makes it the most universal account of this sort of misanthropy of all.
Yeah.
Precisely because it's the thing that nobody wants to think about, nobody wants to admit, nobody wants to be harangued about. The attempt to try to, like, bring it into the level of social activism, you know, just is just, like, grossly self-parodic, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, it would just be, like, more mental health care, or, you know, like...
Just, it doesn't exist on anyone's radar, right?
Yeah.
And, like, every now and then there'll be some sop to it. Every now and then something will happen that will cause people to think about it, right? Like, a guy will shoot a bunch of baskets, right, for the Knicks.
Yeah.
And then like, all of these people will, like, leap at the moment to have their say, and, you know, there'll be these blog posts.
Yes.
And, but all that does is just underscore the underlying fact that, like, it doesn't matter to anyone.
Yeah.
And yet, like... that in itself can be sort of like the existential human condition in itself, right?
Yeah. Would you broaden it? Like, you know, notably absent in the piece are Asian women are not heavily represented in the piece, or, you know, like, do you feel like a need to sort of cover all your bases, or to even focus more into your own concentric circle?
I think it's better to focus on the concentric circle. Initially, I went out sort of, you know, I talked to a bunch of people about this stuff, and there's all this formulaic stuff, and it's, like, of no interest to me, right? Like, oh, where are you from? Oh, that's so insulting that somebody would ask that of me.
Right.
Are you implying that I'm a perpetual... like, that means nothing to me, right? And you know, I have much deeper sort of discontents, and...
It's interesting how that concentric circle and that idea of making people feel... I'm not in that concentric circle. I'm not Asian, for listeners who have not looked at a picture of me. But while I was reading your writing, I was feeling a lot to begin with. But I was also, like, you know, it keeps sort of, like, referencing, like, I'm not a 6 foot tall white man. Like, only 15% of men are over 6 foot. I was like, oh, I'm an over 6 foot tall white man. I was like, I have always felt like, you know, not like an underdog, but I felt many of the misanthropic things that you have felt. But then I was like, oh, I'm also the white man. I'm also the, like, tall white man in the story. So there is a weird level of that hyper-specificity sort of puts everyone on a certain kind of a blast about who they are and their relation to that concentric circle.
Yeah, but I don't think I fail to put myself on blast for everything else.
Definitely
so,
not.
I mean, I have a piece. I have a short thing coming out. Harper's is doing a roundtable on sort of student protests. Mm. And I was tapped to do it because I've been quite vociferous, you know, in my on social media activity, sort of like attacking the sort of attacks on free speech, right?
Okay.
That are coming out of all of this new race and gender jargon, right? That's
yes.
Coming out of the universities. But I ended up taking, like, a pretty different tack because. It turned into something different, and I still think I have a piece. It's like I could do this thing just like taking a kind of libertarian stance and blasting people, right?
Yeah.
But that's not where it ended up at all, and I ended kind of putting myself on blast in this way. That
seems to be a common theme. are you ever going to write a piece that's kind to yourself?
Well, but you know. Nietzsche always said that, you know, when you blast yourself, right?
Yeah.
There's the part of yourself that you're blasting, but then there's also the assertion of the self that is doing the blasting.
Right. I have the power to blast myself.
But there's also tremendous pride in it, right? And
right.
Then there's also like there's daring in being able to do it in public, and then there's daring in being able to take on all this risk. But also, like, to be able to pull it off, right? And it's hard to do. And I'm pretty convinced that I've done it.
How did you know? I'm just curious. You said that some people told you not to publish that Cho piece. And I'm guessing there was even people probably who were against publishing Paper Tigers, knowing that it would be, like, controversial. When someone says, don't put this out. What is that, just sort of a internal confidence to know, like, I'm going to do it, it's worth it to me?
Well, you know, I definitely oscillate between a kind of being the meek Asian man to the, you know, and this is something that I think Jay talks about. I think it's like a very Korean trait to sort of forbear and then like explode in rage, right?
Yeah, he described in Jay's piece, there's a Korean word for it that doesn't exist in English, just sort of like silent rage.
No, the word is han, and you know, it refers to the sort of my understanding of it, which is not very good, but like the accumulated injustice, the rage that accumulates over time and then expends itself in a sudden, abrupt, and totally uncalled for right explosion. So for me, you know, like, you know, I will go through life just kind of deferring and bowing, and then I become very bloody minded all of a sudden. And so like that kind of happens when I have these pieces where I'm like, oh my God, you know, like I can't put this out there, and and then I'll read it and like, this is fucking awesome, you know, like put it out there, right? And then we put it out, and it worked out.
So writing is sort of your explosion.
I oscillate between the two modes, and you know, I'm 20% of the time I'm in a mode of like great self-confidence. And it's in those moments that like the things get done. And then for me, so now it's about sort of acquiring certain ancillary skills to be able to, and then like the mindset and the ability to just like absorb large bodies of information and be an expositor that is friendly to the reader, right? For 80% of a piece in order for it to appear in a magazine for whom that's necessary. And then marry it to this other more volatile element that I feel is like the thing that I have to offer. So it's like, can you take that volatile element and can you supplement it and can you temper it and can you modulate it for different voices and venues? And I actually don't know. I may just have to like eventually go rogue and write a kind of like a messy stew of a novel, right? Not like a perfect well-made one, but a Welbeckian, essayistic, Tristan Shandy-esque assemblage that would qualify as a novel. Man Without Quality-esque kind of, you know, sprawling thing. More and more, I think that is what I want to write. But I'm doing more talking about it than actually doing it.
I mean, I'd read it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Wes Yang.
Thank you.
And that was the Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky, sitting in on the credits for Aaron Lammer, who did that interview with Wesley Yang. Thanks to both of them. It was a conversation I will not soon forget. Thanks also to Evan Ratliff. He's our co-host. Jenna Weiss-Berman's our editor. Our intern this week, Courtney Harrell. Thanks to our sponsors, MailChimp, Trunk Club, and Home Chef. If you want to make restaurant-quality meals at home without the hassle, try Home Chef. They'll deliver fresh ingredients to your house. It takes under 30 minutes to make the meal, and it costs less than $10. If you go to homechef.com/longform and use the code longform at checkout, you'll get $20 off. We'll see you next week. I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah. I don't want to do your dirty work no more. I'm a fool to do your dirty work, oh yeah.